This is Ron Stockton.
Okay, this is a talk I really don't want to deliver. I've been putting it off. In fact, I've never delivered this talk before last year, and I thought I really had to because of things that happened on the Ann Arbor campus. It has to do with the effort of organized groups, mostly associated with the Jewish community, to create a definition of anti-Semitism, to weaponize anti-Semitism in a sense, to try to shut down debate over Israeli policies, to marginalize those who raise issues, to use the term anti-Semitism as a weapon in the struggle of power. It doesn't just have to do with that word, but it has to do with a whole variety of things. What happened in the Ann Arbor campus was that a professor named John Cheney Leopold was asked to write a letter of support for one of his students who was going to a program in Israel. And he said, "I'm sorry, I'm observing." He said, "I'll write a letter for you for any other program." He apparently liked the student and had a good opinion of her. "But I can't write a letter for you for this because I'm engaged in a boycott of Israel." Simultaneously, there was a young woman, a senior graduate student in political science, who her name was Lucy. And she also had a student who asked for a letter of reference. And she met with that student, which I think was really smart. And she said to the student, "I can't support a student to participate in a program that all of my students couldn't participate in. Your program would exclude almost all of my students. So I can't possibly write a letter for such a thing." That seemed to me a very, I mean, if I had a student who wanted to go to a program which was exclusionary, I would have real doubts about that. But anyway, Cheney Leopold was attacked. He became a national cause celeb, as we might say. There were 60, count them, 60 off-campus groups that within a couple of weeks wrote letters, Jewish groups, that wrote letters to the president of the university and to the regents, condemning this and demanding that the university act against Cheney Leopold. A member of the Israeli cabinet renounced him. This just got really out of control. He was renounced by his dean. He was told, "You will not receive a pay raise this year, and you will not receive your sabbatical." He was eligible for a research sabbatical. "You will not receive your sabbatical for 2 years." I think that was the penalty. And when he explained to his class, he discussed with this incident with his class, explaining that he was not an anti-Semite, that he had reasons for doing what he did, he received a follow-up letter reprimanding him for explaining the issues to his class. The woman, the female student, female graduate student, received a letter from her chair rebuking her for her action and telling her that, in writing, that if she did this again, she would suffer serious consequences, whatever that means. She was bold. She, Lucy Peterson, she was very bold. She wrote an open letter that was published in the student newspaper. It was really, really good. She said, "I'm Jewish, and I was always taught that we shouldn't engage in discriminatory practices. That's what I think it means to be Jewish. And I am quite happy at the decision that I made." Cheney Leopold, the professor, has not spoken publicly, so far as I know. I was, for 17 years until last year, I was faculty ombudsman on this campus, which means that it was my job to stand up for the rights of faculty. If some faculty member was being treated unfairly, I was supposed to raise those issues, and I did. I did my job well. To me, we have a process on this campus. If someone does something wrong, if a faculty member does something abusive or wrong, there's a procedure. You set up a committee and you investigate. There's a charge filed. The faculty member has a right to defend against the charges. None of that was done. This was done by administrative fiat under extreme pressure from external forces. The president of the university, Schlissel, set up a special committee under our former president, James Duderstadt, who's an engineer, and stacked it heavily with top-level administrators. And they spent 5 months to come up with a recommendation. And that was very interesting. The dean in Kassel asked me to head a committee. One of their recommendations was that every unit should write a policy on what to do about what policy should be about writing letters. And I was asked to head the committee in Kassel, and we came up with a really good policy, which I will send to you. I will attach it. I will put it in your folder so that you can read it. I have to tell you, this is very disturbing. There's a man named Nathan Thrall. I'm going to put his article. He wrote a really superb article. He's not an ideologue. He's simply an analyst. He works for the Cato Institute, which is a libertarian think tank, and they focus very heavily on individual rights. He wrote an article about evidence of pressuring people to stifle their criticisms of Israel. You have the Prime Minister of Israel, Benjamin Netanyahu, who has openly renounced BDS, boycott, divest, sanctions, And he said that this is an existential threat to the very survival of Israel. Now, to me, I'm thinking to myself, if I say I'm not going to eat Sabra hummus because it tastes like sawdust, and someone else says I'm not going to eat Sabra hummus because it's a company owned by an Israeli-American dual citizen, I'm not sure how either of those threatens the survival of the Jewish state. But that's what Netanyahu has said. And I got entangled in this myself from a research perspective because I attend a Presbyterian church. I'm not a member, but I attend. And the Presbyterians in the early 2000s decided that they would sell 5 stocks from their portfolio. They have a large retirement portfolio for their ministers and officials, and they have another investment portfolio which supports their programs. And back in the 70s, during the fight against apartheid in South Africa, white rule, they had developed a policy that they would not own any stock which had a military or weapons component to it and provided weapons to anyone in a conflict. That was a policy which goes back into the 70s, a long time ago. And they had sold off some shares of companies that operated in South Africa. So that was the precedent for the Presbyterians. When they sold off, when this motion came before the Presbyterian Church, by the way, I wrote three lengthy articles on this. They're very good, I must say. I've sent you one of them. You are not required to read that, but I think you would find it very interesting if you did, about how these things operate and work out. When the Presbyterians made their first proposal to about 15 years ago to sell five stocks, they were going to sell Caterpillar, they were going to sell United Technologies, a couple of military stocks, a couple of electronic stocks that were providing face recognition and that sort of thing, monitoring techniques. When they announced that they were going to sell that, the head of the denomination, this is an administrator, not like a bishop or anything like that, but he's the prominent person. He said, "I do not want my retirement package to be partially supported by a group participating in the occupation of the Palestinian territories." For him, this was a moral decision, almost a religious decision. From the point of Netanyahu, this was seen as an effort to destroy the state of Israel. At least that's how he portrayed it to his followers, and they believed him. Our student government a few years ago wrote a divestment resolution. I thought it was very, very carefully written. It was very thoughtful. Didn't engage in name-calling. It was very focused on simply asking the regions to do what the Standard Practices Guide requires. Now, the Standard Practices Guide, that's the rule book which governs the university. It has everything in it. And one of the things in it, starting way back during the time of apartheid, was that if an element of the university thinks that there is a moral question involved with a given investment, the university regents should set up a committee to examine this and determine whether there's any basis of doing this. This is not a call. The setting up a committee is simply setting a committee. It's not a call to do anything. It's just a call to decide whether there's a proper moral a basis for a concern. And we've sold off fossil fuels and other things like that. So it's not as if this is unprecedented. Anyway, when our students presented that to the regents, one of the regents, the chair of the regents, said this is anti-Semitic, it's morally bankrupt, it's double standard, it's questioning the right of Israel to survive. It was like he had been in training, and the training kicked in, and he just started saying these words. He was a good man. He is a good man. And he's done a lot of good for the university. But he wasn't thinking. It was an unreflective attack on people. He had been trained to think this way. He hadn't even thought through the implications. So I wrote an article on what happened to the Presbyterians, and I think you'll find it very interesting. The other two articles I could send you if anybody wanted to see them. I would be glad to send those to you. We've had some bad situations on our own campus. Once we had a... oh my goodness, this was back in the 80s, I would think. It was Martin Luther King Day. And a group of African Americans and Arabs, mostly, those were the two groups that were most interested, set up a panel. And it was declared to be an official Martin Luther King Day event. And it had on it an African American, a South African, a person of Irish heritage, and a Palestinian. And the topic of the panel was comparative liberation movements. Well, the Anti-Defamation League, a major Jewish organization, contacted the chancellor. And so she shut it down. I sent her a strong letter a strong private letter, as did one of my Jewish colleagues who sent her a strong letter saying, look, this makes it look like the Jews control everything. You're contributing to a problem, and the problem is not attacks on Israel. It's making Jews look as if they can manipulate things behind the scenes. Please don't do that. Anyway, the event ran as a student-sponsored event. They didn't stop the event, but they simply withdrew the recognition as an official Martin Luther King Day event. We had another situation that occurred. I was the faculty advisor for SJP. This is Students for Justice in Palestine. And that group supports BDS. I've never taken a position on BDS myself. I'm not an activist. I don't speak to rallies. I don't march in demonstrations. I don't do those things. I'm an academic. I try to reach all my students. And I feel I couldn't do both of those things. Some other people do, and they feel they can, and that's their obligation. I'm not questioning them. I'm just saying that I don't. But I was the sponsor of SJP. And they wanted to hold a checkpoint. This is something that Palestinians do. Palestinians go through checkpoints. I've been through those checkpoints. Just because I got in a line that was a Palestinian line, you have to be checked. And it's really humiliating. There's someone who's 19, he's got a weapon, he looks frightened, he's looking at us, he's checking us, he's looking at our bags, whatever it may be. They wanted to hold a checkpoint on campus. And they were going to do it right near the university center. Now, you know, by the university center, there's a sidewalk which goes kind of farthest away from the center itself. So, and that's a wide sidewalk. So they were going to set up their checkpoint on that point. And anybody could just walk past it. They weren't going to block the sidewalk or anything. It was just going to be there. Nobody had to go through that didn't want to go through. They couldn't get a permit. You've got to have the student activities office has to sign off on something like this. It's just a signature. They just sign off. So I contacted the head of student, the dean, the vice chancellor for student activities. We had a vice chancellor, now we have a dean. Head of vice chancellor for student activities. I contacted this person. I said, what's the problem? Could we talk? My students keep asking for this. They're not giving an answer. You're not even saying yes or no. And could we talk? So he said, yeah, okay, let's sit down and talk. So we set up a meeting time. I walked in. I was amazed. All the top university people were there. Head of counseling center was there. Student activities director was there. People I'd never met were there. And I said, okay, well, what's the problem? He said, oh, there's no problem. I said, well, the students can't get a signature. Well, okay, we'll give them a signature. I said, okay, what else? And so the head of counseling service, who's not here anymore, said, well, we're worried that there could be some psychological trauma. And I said, okay, what's the trauma? Well, we don't know. And I'm thinking, what are you thinking? That there's a student, a Palestinian student who's been through a checkpoint? Someone has been tortured in Iraq or Syria? That's possible. But a person like that wouldn't have to go through the checkpoint. Are you thinking that some Jewish student would be traumatized by this? I didn't have the slightest idea. They wouldn't tell me the kind of student that they were concerned about. And I said, well, what do you suggest? And they said, well, we want it to be known that there will be counselors on call if anybody needs to have counseling. And I thought, well, this is really an overreaction. You're just going through. They just go through and they say, okay, here, stand here. And they'll look you over and then let you go through. It's not exactly a traumatic experience. It's just an experience. Very strange. I think these people are overreacting. These people are afraid. I can tell they're afraid. I've had interesting experiences myself. I teach this course on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And I hope you think I'm fair. I hope you think I'm balanced. Oops, fair and balanced. That sounds like Fox News. No, I'm not Fox News. I hope you think I've treated all of the different groups that we've encountered with respect. But you know what? Some people think if you treat our enemies with respect, that means you're secretly behind them. So people get a little bit, they're looking for enemies. There's a phrase, in search of enemies. You know, if you're looking for enemies, you're always going to be successful. Congratulations. I've twice had FOIA requests filed against me. FOIA, Freedom of Information Act, FOIA, F-O-I-A. I'm a public official. I don't know if you knew that. I'm an employee of the state of Michigan. And as such, my records, my files, are public information. Now, not my personnel files. If they wanted to find out my health record or something, if I've had a disease or treatment, or if I received mental illness or venereal disease, none of those are true. But if I had, they couldn't find that out, my private personnel files. But anything like my salary and what I do and my roles and different things like that, they could find out that I'm faculty ombudsman. It's right there in the file. It's not a secret. I just told you. So twice I've had FOIA requests against me. Why are those FOIA requests? I don't know. One was by an off-campus organization, a right-wing Jewish organization that considers itself a defender of Israel. I'll not tell you the name of the organization. It's really on the hard right. But they get treated seriously. Members of Congress listen to these people. They were setting up a hit on me. I knew that because someone within the organization was tipping me off. What did they think they were going to find? A letter from Osama bin Laden saying, here, professor, here's your monthly $10,000 stipend. Keep up the good work. Is that what they thought they would find? I don't know. What is in the heads of people who file a FOIA request against you? Another request was from a vigilante. A lot of these people think that I'm going to be the hero and save the day when nobody else will act. So was a senior person who signed up for one of my classes, and we read some things he didn't like. I told you on the first day, didn't I, that we were going to be reading things you didn't like? Yeah, well, you're students. You're serious about this. You're willing to read things you don't like. But sometimes people get above a certain age, and they don't want to hear things they don't like. I'm not down on people above a certain age. I'm just saying that once in a while, there's a mindset of people. You people are students. That person wasn't a student. So he filed a Freedom of Information request against me. A third person registered for my class and filed a complaint. It was this class. And file a complaint against the reading list. He said, well, there's some extremist views in there. Yeah, well, I told you that on the first day. So, I'm proud of that. I am proud that I'm having you read things that you don't like. And you've been really good about that. So he said, there's things in there. And this escalated. It went to the dean. You know, I had to have a meeting. And it was kind of unpleasant. But, of course, there's nothing there. The fact that I'm having you read stuff that you don't like, well, no kidding. Do you want to have this based on the real world or in some kind of fantasy world? Well, it's the real world. We have to do that. There's a definition of anti-Semitism. Let me tell you this. I'll read it to you. It's the official State Department definition of anti-Semitism. By the way, anti-Semitism is a form of racism. It's everyone who studies this seriously agrees that anti-Semitism is a form of racism. At the University of Michigan, for example, being a racist is grounds for dismissal. You can lose your job if you're a racist. So being accused of anti-Semitism is not just name-calling. It can have really, really serious consequences. It could destroy your career. So, let me just tell you some phrases from out of the State Department definition. I think I'll provide this to you so you can read it if you want to. It's a certain perception of Jews involving hatred of Jews, rhetorical and physical manifestations, Well, we can all agree that if someone attacks a Jew, that's a really awful thing. But just insulting a Jew, that's rhetorical manifestations. This involves examples of anti-Semitism, involves justifying killing or harming Jews. Okay, wait a minute. Justifying. This is really a tricky word. Suppose, you know, the last time I was in Jerusalem, I met a man whose daughter had been, he was an Israeli. His daughter had been blown up in a suicide bombing. There was a terrible incident in which a bombing occurred on Saturday afternoon during the weekend, and all the young people had gone down to this really fancy street in Jerusalem, and a bomb had gone off, and a bunch of kids were killed, and he had joined an organization with a Palestinian man, whose daughter was killed, and he said, "I say to people that the enemy is not another person." He got really attacked within the Israeli community, the Jewish community, because of being in this organization. And he said, "I say to people, the problem is not another person. The problem is the occupation. When you have the occupation, you are going to have violent attacks on people." Now, is that justifying? Saying that Israeli policy is causing these attacks, is that justifying those attacks? I don't think so. We analyze things. But, you know, I introduced you at the very beginning of the semester, I introduced you to the concept of unintended advocacy. Sometimes when you just analyze the situation, people and you don't say it the way somebody wants you to say it, scoring points on their enemies, well, they'll think you're an advocate, when in fact you're just trying to do your job as a political scientist. It involves, according to this definition, the State Department definition of anti-Semitism, it involves stereotypical allegations about Jews, including that the Jews collectively as a community are very powerful. Well, when you can get 60 Jewish organizations within 2 weeks to send a letter to the president of the University of Michigan because of what, some obscure professor that no one has ever heard of. He's not an activist. I asked Cheney Leopold, I sent him an email. I said, "John, how did they find out about you? Why did they target you? Are you an activist? Are you involved in organizations? Do you sign petitions? Do you deliver speeches?" He says, "No, I don't do anything. Just as a matter of conscience, I decided that I would not support this, that I would not write this letter." So, if you say the Jewish community is really good at intimidating people, is that anti-Semitic? Well, according to this definition, it is. Suggesting that Jews are dominant in the media, that's anti-Semitic. Here's another definition. Jews or Israel exaggerate the Holocaust. Well, I'm not sure you can exaggerate the Holocaust because those people died. But on the other hand, I think it's possible to make the Holocaust central to everything. And every time someone raises an issue, say, you know, you're trying to bring about another Holocaust. That's abuse of the Holocaust. Is that what we're talking about? Exaggerating the Holocaust? I think there are people who exaggerate the Holocaust. I think the Prime Minister of Israel, Benjamin Netanyahu, is one of them. Applying double standards, this is a common phrase, double standards. You're requiring Israel to comply with standards that you don't require other countries. Why do you criticize Israel when you don't criticize Iran? You just delivered a statement criticizing Israel. Why didn't you also criticize Iran? Well, maybe it's because we give a lot of money to Israel every year. Maybe it's because Israel's an ally and Iran is not an ally, and we have no control over them and no influence over them. This is very strange. Double standards. What does that mean? I can't even tell what it means. Conducting a human rights investigation. There's a group called Human Rights Watch, HRW. They do really good reports. I've used their reports in this class sometimes. Human Rights Report. They issue individual reports. They'll issue a report about Israel. They'll issue a report about Iran. They issue a report about Honduras, whatever it may be. They'll issue a report about women being trafficked in the United States. But they issue reports one at a time. And whenever they issue a report on Israel, they'll be besieged. I was on a panel once, a human rights panel once, and at a national convention, the Middle East Studies Conference. And the person in charge of the Israeli desk, who presided over those studies of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, she was on the panel, and she and I had a chat. And she said, every time I issue a report of any kind involving Israel, I am besieged. Besieged. With complaints, objections, emails, accusations, whatever it may be. Are you singling out Israel? If today you issue a report on Israel's human rights abuses and 2 weeks from now you issue a report, a different branch of the unit issues a report on Iranian human rights abuses, and 2 weeks later someone issues a report on the abuse of young women in the United States. Are you singling out Israel? I don't know. To some people you are, because on this day, your report didn't say, oh, by the way, in Iran is probably as bad as Israel. And then, finally, efforts to delegitimize Israel are considered anti-Semitic. And denying Israel's right to exist. Okay, this is a tricky phrase, isn't it? Are you denying the right of the state of Israel to exist, or are you denying the right of Israel to exist as a Jewish state? That's different. You see, there are Israelis, we've talked about this already, there are Israelis who would say, let's stick with the Declaration of Independence and define Israel as a state of all of its people. Of course, it's a Jewish homeland, but let's define the state, the structures of government, as a state of all of its people. Hebrew can be a language. Arabic can be a language. English can be a language, if that makes it easier. And then Benjamin Netanyahu comes along and passes his Jewish state law, which declares that this is a Jewish state. And what are a state? A state, remember, is the structures of power, structures of coercion and control. That's how we defined it. And so Israel, the state of Israel, the structures, the legal system, everything is Jewish. And Arabic is a recognized language, but not in the status that it had in the original Israeli Declaration of Independence. If there are a lot of Israelis who object to that, you got a right to exist, but you don't have a right to exist as a Jewish state. We're going to change that if we get a chance. Is that renouncing Israel as a Jewish state? Or saying, I'll recognize Israel's right to exist, but I'm not going to recognize your right to exist as a Jewish state. Is that anti-Semitic? Well, we got to be careful here, because there are a very large number of Jews who take exactly that position. But that's what I said. You can weaponize anti-Semitism. Now, I got to tell you, as a faculty ombudsman for 17 years, if a faculty member had come to me and said, this is now someone else's problem because I'm no longer the ombudsman, but if a faculty member had come to me and said, I'm being accused of anti-Semitism based on some of these terms, I would say, I don't even know how to interpret those terms. Well, how do you define those terms? You have to be able to, in law, an offense has to be so clearly specified that you can know for certain if you violated it or not. Israel's right to exist. What does that mean? Criticizing Israel only? Does that mean today or tomorrow? Does that mean someone who focuses on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and who talks about Israeli issues is an anti-Semite if they don't already also talk about the violation of human rights in Honduras, which are very serious? These are definitional problems. You just can't really be satisfied with the issues involved here. Let's see, what else do I want to say? Oh, yes. There is a systematic effort to deny faculty members promotions or appointments. Let me give you some cases which have gotten really big attention among those of us who care. Juan Cole is the former head of the Middle East Studies Center in Ann Arbor. He's a major scholar. He writes a blog. If you are not on his Facebook blog, you should probably join. He's got really insights that other people miss. Juan Cole was about to be stolen. Yale University was going to steal him from us. And everything was in place. The faculty were delighted. The dean was delighted. The provost was delighted. And then it got to the regents. And the regents suddenly got besieged by letters saying, this man is an anti-Semite. He's anti-Israeli. He's this and that. Well, they canceled the appointment. There's a man named Norman Finkelstein. I kind of don't like Norman Finkelstein. I've read several of his books, and some of them are really good. Others are argumentative, I think. But his personality is very prickly. He got into a spit fight with Alan Dershowitz, and somehow I got dragged into that. He quoted something something I wrote in which I referred to 3,000 people being killed during Black September. And Alan Dershowitz attacked him and said, "This is not research. Why are you quoting?" Okay, it's not research, Alan. I know that. I didn't go to Jordan and interview people and check for burial sites and death reports and whatever it is, death certificates. I didn't do that. It's not research. I just took what everybody else says. And in fact, that's what the Correlates of War Project, my colleague Professor Wayman, has the Correlates of War Project. And he said, 3,000, that's the figure we use. That's, everybody uses that figure. So anyway, Finkelstein was a professor at a small Catholic school in the Chicago area. And when he came up for tenure, Alan Dershowitz began a systematic campaign against him, attacking the institution, saying it was a betrayal of Catholic values, implications of engagement, Catholic engagement with the Holocaust. We thought you had gotten beyond that. Now you're going to hire this person who's a Holocaust denier, which Finkelstein is not. I've read his book. It definitely does not deal with anything, and some of his relatives escaped or were killed in the Holocaust, so it's not as if he's going to be making excuses for those people. Anyway, he was denied tenure. Steve Salida, I think, is probably the worst case. Steve is someone I know. He's a really fine person. He's actually quoted me in some of his research. I'm really happy at that. He applied for the job as head director of the Center for Arab American Studies on our campus, and I kind of wish he had taken it, but he didn't, and we hired the wrong person, who is no longer with us, thank goodness. Anyway, Steve is from West Virginia. I think it's West Virginia. He's got a nice West Virginia accent. He wrote an article comparing American treatment of Native Americans with Israeli treatment of Palestinians, drawing comparisons. The University of Illinois Center for Native American Studies wanted to hire him. I think it would have been a joint appointment. He would have had a couple of different, maybe political science, maybe history. I don't know what the other appointments were. They were so happy. The search committee singled him out. They said, yes, you're what we want. And the department approved it unanimously. Everybody approved it. The dean approved it. The provost approved it. It went all the way up to the regents, and suddenly, wham, there was an explosion of attacks on him. Letters began pouring into the regents. The regents hadn't even received, at that point, the regents had not even received the recommendation. And they voted. I watched on YouTube, I watched the debates, the discussions of the regents. Each regent gave an explanation of why they were voting. The vote was unanimous, with two exceptions. There were two African-American regents who said, look, we know about discrimination. We know about people objecting for whatever reason to your appointment. We know all about that. We're not going to support that. So Steve was denied his appointment. At this point, he had resigned his previous job, which was a mistake. You never resign until you're in place. He was in the schedule to teach in the fall. This was the summer appointment. And he had an office. Steve now drives a school bus to support his family. I'm on his Facebook. Once in a while, he posts things. He says he's happy. He had a one-year appointment at the American University of Beirut, and that wasn't renewed after 1 year. I think there was probably pressure. He didn't say. These are these are efforts to wreck careers. Remember that Lucy Peterson, the senior graduate student that I told you had refused to write a letter in Ann Arbor. I was following the comments on that case, and one person said, the really good news is she will never get a job anywhere in any university. That's kind of scary, don't you think? So what is this great power that Jews have? What is it? By the way, I want to mention something. There's an organization called Canary Mission. It's a group of students. They operate on campus. They're right wing groups connected in some way to Israeli security. I don't know how they are, but their job is to monitor their classmates and monitor professors. They'll sign up for a class, keep records, submit reports, which engage in selective reporting. You know, I say a lot of things to you that I don't believe. I say them to provoke you and make you think. All professors do that. And you can take those statements and run them together and say, look, this professor is in favor of whatever. You can do that. You can engage in a conversation with a student. A classmate. And say, what do you think? I kind of agree. Yeah, what do you think? And then you can report that person to the organization, and then they set up a hit on that student or create a file on them, whatever it may be. That's probably what happened to Cheney Leopold and Peterson in Ann Arbor. I'm on the faculty senate, and when this happened, I sent the chancellor an email saying, I have a statement I'm going to read to the Faculty Senate, and I'm going to ask you the following questions about what are we going to do, given the university has taken these positions. So I did that. And I think he was appreciative that I sent this to him. I didn't blindside him. I sent this to him in advance. And I said, okay, what is your position? And he said, well, he basically repeated the position of the president, President Schlissel. And he said, but I can tell you that the senior officers, now senior officers, that means the president of the University of Michigan, the provost, the deans of the different, I think there are 19 deans in Ann Arbor, the chancellor of Dearborn, the chancellor of Flint, I don't know, there's a cluster of those people. They meet once a month. He said at our meeting, we spent a couple of hours discussing this issue. And he said, there was grave concern about the role of Canary Mission in what happened. No kidding. No kidding. Anyway, I was glad that they found that out. They figured that out. Isn't that good? Back to this article, Thrall, Norman Thrall, who wrote that article. Sorry, Nathan Thrall, who wrote that article on anti-Semitism and how it's being weaponized. And I'm going to provide that to you. It's not required reading, but some of you might want to read it. Thrall says, well, the Republican Party at this point has moved so far to the right that whatever Netanyahu does, they're going to think it's okay. Which is interesting because 40 years ago, the Republican Party had real doubts about Israel's policy. And it was the Democrats who were full in with the Israelis. President Bush, the father, was very resistant to Israeli annexation of the West Bank and settlements. That's not true anymore. The Republican Party doesn't raise a peep at whatever Netanyahu does. It's the Democratic Party who seems very reluctant to criticize Israel. So why is that? Ilhan Omar, the representative from Minneapolis, she's of Somali birth, she made a statement about campaign contributions, how they were playing an unhealthy role in American politics. And she said, it's all about the Benjamins. She was quoting a rap song, actually, which her audience knew immediately that she had listened to this rap song. But the fact is that she said, it's all about the Benjamins. Benjamin, of course, Franklin is on a $100 bill. So she was renounced as anti-Semitic. This is suggesting that Jews control the political system through money. Jews manipulate the system. You can buy politicians. And she ultimately apologized. I really like her, but on the other hand, I think she's not ready for prime time. She often says things that kind of get her in trouble. You should never say something that's going to get you in trouble, and you have to back off. Nathan Thrall had a really interesting factoid. He said the real issue in any presidential campaign has to do with the mega donors. What is a mega donor? A mega donor is someone who gives $500,000 or more to a party group. Now, you can't give that much money to a candidate, but if the Senate has a Senate campaign fund, you can give them $500,000 because they're spreading that across the whole country. So $500,000, if someone walks in and says, I got $500,000, if somebody's going to say, oh, well, that's lovely. Would you like to go out to dinner? There's a very nice restaurant here. I'll treat. And $500,000, that's a pile of money. Three quarters to the Democratic Party, three quarters of all the mega donors are Jewish. And Thrall actually quotes some people, some some quoted on record and some quoted off record, who's saying it really does come down to the Benjamins. When someone comes to you and says, I will give a pile of money to your PAC if you will issue the following statement, it's going to be very hard for a candidate to say, take your money on principle. I'm not going to take your money. I'm not going to make that statement. I don't believe that's correct. Even if you know for certain that a given policy, a given Netanyahu policy, is ultimately going to produce destruction for Israel, massive destruction, massive harm, another uprising, a terrible situation. Even if you know that's going to happen, it's hard to turn down that money. So he says, it's not Jewish public opinion. It's not the Jewish voters. He said the average Jewish voter is very okay with criticizing Israel. This has been repeated in poll after poll. Jews are quite happy with criticizing Israel. A lot of Jews criticize Israel. And the average Jew, the average Jewish voter, you ask them exactly how are you deciding how to vote, Israel, they all want Israel to be safe and secure. Okay, everybody wants Israel to be safe and secure. But that's not how they vote. Jews don't vote based on Israel. There's just a handful of very right-wing Israelis who vote based on Israel. Most of them vote on the economy or on justice or some other issue. Jews tend to be progressive in the political system, so they vote on progressive issues. And Israel is, and if somebody criticizes Israel, that's probably not going to flip anybody's vote. Likewise, the evangelicals play, the evangelicals are very pro-Israeli, but they don't really monitor these issues much. Plus, they're not really involved in party politics. Plus, they're heavily on the Republican side, and they're not going to change. And all you have to do is say abortion or gay marriage or guns, and you've got their vote. They're in favor of Israel. They're sympathetic to Israel. Their ideology teaches them to respect Israel, but that doesn't change their vote. And therefore, their input into the political system really doesn't change attitudes towards Israel in any way. It's on the Democratic side that they're very dependent on these mega donors. And this brings us to a couple of things. First, Bernie Sanders. When Bernie Sanders ran for president 4 years ago for the nomination against Hillary, an issue came up during one of the debates about these mega donors. They're called super PACs. That's the code word, super PACs. But believe me, it's not the fact that you send in $14 that makes a super PAC a super PAC. Every candidate says, my average donation is only $14. Yeah, that's what goes to you, but the super PACs are really where it's at. So what did Bernie say? He said, you can keep your damn money. I don't want billionaire money. You can keep your damn money. We're going to fund this campaign out of individual donors. And he did. He did. That means that Bernie Sanders is really a threat. He's a traditional Jewish leftist. His commitment is to social justice, to a political system that represents people, not interests. There's also another thing. This country is becoming very diverse. This country is becoming very diverse. Right now, the number of babies, I think it just flipped, or it's going to flip in a couple of months. In a couple of months, the percentage of babies born who are white will drop below 50% for the first time. It'll be 49.9. And it'll take us a while to see that. But the simple fact is, we got a lot of people out there in this God bless America country of ours who are not white. We got Hispanics, we got Arabs, we got Africans, and a bunch of other groups that I haven't thought about. And the simple fact is, that those people kind of share an identity. They kind of see Netanyahu within a context of white oppression. Now, I got to tell you, if you're Jewish, that drives you crazy. Like, why are you comparing us to South Africa? That's not a fair comparison. Well, I've studied both South Africa and I've studied Israel. I've written on both of them. And I can tell you it's not a direct comparison. But I got to tell you also, they're in the same family. They're not exactly twins. They're not even cousins, but they're in the same family. There are some historic parallels. So suddenly, the Democratic Party, which is where anybody who's non-white is probably in the Democratic Party. There are a few people who are not white in the Republican Party, but I got to tell you, almost all of them are in the Democratic Party. So you're seeing something. Now, you people are going to get to see this more than I do because I'm getting near the end of my career. I'm retiring at the end of this year. And so you're going to get to work on this, and I hope you do a better job than my generation did. We kind of messed it up. But you're going to come into a country, and you're lucky too. You're lucky to be in a country that is more diverse than the country I grew up in. Growing up in my country, it kind of made us narrow. I don't mean to be down on myself or my classmates or my cousins or anybody, my generation. But it kind of made us narrow if all the people we knew were like us. You're growing up in a different country. And I know some of you are Republicans. I know some of you support Donald Trump. That's fine. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm just saying that there's a dynamic out there which is going to change this country. And the Democratic Party is going to be torn between those super PACs and Bernie Sanders.